Beloved, in our four sermons on Philippians 4, we consider the triad peace, contentment, and joy. Though you're familiar with faith, hope, and charity, here's another three. The way of peace is, according to verses 6 through 9, the way of praying, letting all our anxieties be known to God, verse 6. The way of thinking of spiritual and divine things, verse 8. And the way of obedience to God, following Paul's teaching and example, verse 9. After a sermon on peace, as opposed to worrying, we had last week two sermons on Philippians 4, verse 11, the second half, which dealt with contentment, from peace to contentment. We considered the meaning of contentment, that it is satisfaction with the living God, inwardly, by faith, apart from external circumstances. We saw the range of contentment, in whatsoever state I am, contentment, everywhere in all things, contentment, to use phrases from verses 11 and 12. And then we considered the difficult lesson, the learning of contentment, that it comes with time, experience, and effort. That whatever attainment we have reached has come with time, experience, and effort. With time, experience, and effort alongside the activity of faith as appropriating the truth of God's word concerning His gracious care for us. This evening we're turning from peace and contentment to joy. This epistle to the Philippians mentions joy and rejoicing in various forms some 17 times in just four chapters. Philippians could be called the great epistle of joy. And there's a nice quote in your bulletin setting that forth. In Philippians 1 verse 4, Paul talks about praying with joy. Praying for the Philippians with joy at the remembrance of the fellowship he had with them. In chapter 1 verse 18, Paul says that he rejoices in people preaching Christ. Yea, he resolves to rejoice in the preaching of Christ. In chapter 1, verses 25 and 26, Paul's proposed return to them will cause rejoicing to abound, a joy which comes out of faith. Moving to chapter 2, verse 2, it's true church unity which fills up Paul's joy. And indeed the joy of all office bearers. In chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, Paul speaks of his joy in the Philippians on the judgment day. But he's going to rejoice that they will be there as the fruit of his labours. And he rejoices in them now. In chapter 2, verse 18, he says, "And you also rejoice in me, reciprocal joy." In chapter 2, verse 28, the Philippians rejoice in seeing Epaphroditus, one of their own, recover from his illness, and the poor man had nearly died. Chapter 3, verse 1, calls the church to rejoice in the Lord. In chapter 4, verse 1, Paul calls this church my joy and crown. And then we have perhaps the most famous word of joy in this epistle, in chapter 4, verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again I say, rejoice. A lot of rejoicing there. Rejoicing in the saints. Rejoicing in the Lord. Rejoicing in praying. rejoicing in fellowshipping, rejoicing in church unity, rejoicing in preaching. Now, what about our text this evening? What about that part of our text which mentions rejoicing? That is the very beginning of the text. Chapter 4, verse 10, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly." Here's rejoicing. It's rejoicing in the Lord. It's rejoicing greatly. This is the only one of the 17 references to joy and rejoicing in this epistle where there's great rejoicing. And it is the last use of joy or rejoice in this epistle. So what's the occasion of Paul's great joy in this epistle? And the answer, in short, is that the occasion involves a gift. A gift from the Philippians to Paul in Rome, under house arrest, to Paul through Epaphroditus. That's mentioned in chapter 4, verse 18. Let's consider then together Paul's great joy and the Philippians' gift. Paul's great joy and the Philippians' gift. The gift and Paul's needs, that first. The gift and the Philippians' fruit, that second. And the gift and God's approval. Paul's great joy and the Philippians' gift. Relating the gift first to the needs of Paul, the fruit of the Philippians, and the approval of God. Now we might expect, or we might have expected, that Paul's joy at receiving this gift from the Philippians would be because this gift was just what he needed. As I mentioned last Lord's Day, we're not told the form or nature that this gift took. Maybe money, maybe clothing or food or something else. But whatever it was, and it doesn't seem to matter because we're not told, this gift was certainly appropriate to Paul's circumstances and therefore helpful and useful. So Paul receives an appropriate, helpful, useful gift while he's under house arrest. But this was not the reason for his joy. He says in verse 10, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly upon receiving the gift," all right. But it was not because this gift fulfilled some lack or need, because Paul had says that he had learned in whatsoever state he was therewith to be content in Jesus Christ through faith. Not, he says, verse 11, not that I speak in respect of want. That's not it. Because I'm content. I know both how to cope when I have nothing and when I'm rich. Everywhere and in all things I'm instructed both to be full, to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. He goes further in verse 17 and adds that he didn't even seek a gift from them. Not because I desire a gift, he writes. And again, it's evident therefore that Paul's joy, was not in the gift itself. And yet we've got to add that Paul was not thankless. He didn't despise the gift. He wasn't rude or churlish to them and say, "Well, you gave me a gift, but I couldn't care less for your gift. I didn't even need it." No. He delicately, wisely, and gracefully explains negatively and positively in verses 10 through 19 his philosophy, so to speak, of the giving and receiving of gifts, and wherein his joy lies with respect to this gift. He's not pretending to be hyper-spiritual, but he takes this opportunity to explain to them the right way to view and receive a gift like this from the church. What does all this tell us about the Apostle Paul? Well, several things. If If Paul did not desire a gift, or even feel that he needed a gift, it is obvious that he is not governed by or given to covetousness or selfishness. The Apostle Paul is not like the horse leech of Proverbs 30 that's forever crying out, "Give, give." He is not either like the false teachers, so excoriated in the pages of the New Testament, who train their hearts with covetous practices, always out for money. 2 Peter 2:14. Those who run greedily for reward, like Balaam. Jude speaks of them. Paul states elsewhere, "I seek not yours. I'm not interested in your money, but I seek you." That's what I'm after. You, to follow Christ. That was his point. Going a step further, since Paul neither desired nor needed a gift, it is clear that he is not earthly minded. What did Paul bring with him on board the ship to Rome? Very little. What did he escape with when the ship sank off the coast of Malta? Even less. And here he is, chained to a Roman soldier 24 hours a day, and for some time he has been unsure if he's going to live, and he has been setting his affections not on things below, but on things above, where Jesus Christ sits at the right hand of God. He has been thinking and meditating upon the things which are true and honest and just and pure and lovely, and therefore he has peace. Moreover, since Paul neither desired or felt that he needed this gift, even though he's in captivity, it is evident that he has learned to do without what we call creature comforts. I do not speak in respect of want. Whatever state I'm in, I've learned to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. I know what it is to be hungry and how to cope with being hungry. And I know what it is to suffer need and how to cope with suffering need. To use language he himself used in 2 Timothy in his letter to his younger fellow saint, he has learned to endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, to take up the cross and deny himself. Very important lessons, very difficult lessons. Lessons that would be particularly hard for us here in an affluent society, pampered in the 21st century. We ought to face that. We could barely cope with the sort of experiences and hardships Paul faced. Now, what is there here of instruction for us, beloved? Well, immediately before Paul writes of his joy at the Philippians' gift, the joy at their gift, not over the gift as such, but at their gift, he writes this, verse 9. "The things which I have both learned and received, and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you." Which means that if we live the way Paul lives, we will have peace. The peace of God will be with us. The God of peace will be with us. That is, from what we've just seen, the more we live without covetousness, the more we live without earthly mindedness, this is also similar to verse 8, the more we are not enslaved to earthly comforts, which is different from having them, being ensnared by them, then we will imitate the apostle and we will know the way of peace. "The God of peace shall be with you as you mortify covetousness." Stop thinking carnally about this world and esteem other things more important than your own earthly comfort. Difficult lessons. Very difficult lessons for us indeed. We would struggle greatly if we had to cope with 1% of the Apostle Paul's difficulties. But at least we can humble ourselves just a little and learn not to reckon ourselves to be something when we're not. Paul then did not rejoice in the gift, though he was far from being churlish or ungrateful. But Paul did rejoice greatly because of the givers. That's what he was focused on. Paul rejoiced because he saw in the gift not coins or food or a new coat, but because he saw in the gift evidence of their care and concern for him. I rejoiced, verse 10 says, in the Lord greatly, that now at the last your care, your concern for me, hath flourished again. That's why he rejoiced. And the word flourished means blossomed, budded. You have this care, and blossoms begin to grow out of it. And it's in and around that time of the year for us too, or at least for some of the bushes and trees. This blossoming of their care for Paul came after a winter, so to speak, when they had no opportunity to help Paul. Paul doesn't say, you couldn't care less for me for a long time, and now you've bucked yourselves up a bit and you're showing some care. No, he says in verse 10, your care has flourished again, it's budded and blossomed, but you were always careful, you're always concerned for me, but you didn't have an opportunity to show it. Now they had their chances. Now they were able to do what they always wanted to do, that is, help the apostle, for they have an opportunity. And so the good work of their sending to him this gift blossomed, a very beautiful blossom, beautiful to God and to the apostle, and it showed spiritual life. When you see a tree begin to bud and blossom after winter, when you wondered if the thing was dead, you know there's life in it. That's what Paul thought by this gift about these people. The apostle continues the horticultural imagery in verse 17. Not because I desire a gift, that wasn't what I'm seeking from you, but because I desire fruit that may abound to your account. So he talks here not of the blossom, the good works of caring for Paul, but he moves to another stage of the fruit itself, fruit towards God, fruit from them. Out of the care, the blossom, for God's servant comes fruit. They sent me a gift. Paul greatly rejoices in that, not because of the coat or the money, but because of what it revealed about them, the people he labored with long and hard and fellowship with and prayed for many months and years. And Paul not only sees in this gift for him spiritual life and good fruit in God's eyes, he sees the gift as an evidence of Christian fellowship and communion. Look with me at verses 14 and 15. Notwithstanding, verse 14, ye have well done that ye did communicate or share with my affliction, giving this gift, sending your own possessions at cost to you to help me, is sharing in my affliction. It's as if you were with me, chained to this guard. And again, verse 15. Earlier, Paul says, no church communicated with me, shared with me, as concerning giving and receiving. And in identifying with Paul, in sharing their material goods with him, they shared in his afflictions and so exemplified what our creed calls the communion of the saints. Because we share in Jesus Christ and draw our life out of one common head, then we share what we have with one another. And that honors the Lord Jesus. And Paul rejoiced in this, greatly rejoiced in this. He's very glad because their care is flourishing, because they're bringing forth fruit, and because here they are identifying with him under house arrest in Rome. And in receiving this gift, the apostle identifies it, or rather sees it, in the line of previous gifts that he has received from them. Verse 15, "Now ye Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel," the beginning of the gospel in the continent of Europe, when he first came into Greece in Acts 16, "when I departed from Macedonia," that is when I left Philippi, my first port of call, "and headed south and west, no church communicated with me as concerning giving and receiving, but ye only. For even in Thessalonica ye sent once and again unto my necessity." So here's the idea. This ties in with Paul's second missionary journey. He leaves Philippi. He heads, as I said, west and south, comes to Thessalonica, and while he's there, he is supported by no other church, though he isn't admonishing or rebuking the other churches, except the Philippians. And then they supported him on two separate occasions. That's the idea of verse 16. "Even in Thessalonica, ye sent once," first time, "and again," second time, "unto my necessity." So when Paul sees this gift, he remembers back several years and said, "You did this before. You did this before. When you were a very young church, and nobody else was doing it, you did it, and you did it twice." And then came a period in which you had no opportunity to help me. There were no occasions. And now that I'm chained in Rome, another occasion has arisen and you sent another gift, which is good fruit. And so Paul is very quick to remember the previous instances of similar care and love for him. Some of you might recall the great love that the Galatians had for him. He mentions this in Galatians 4, verse 15. He says, "If it were possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me." But then in came the false teachers, taught justification by faith and works, alienated them against Paul. And he says to them, "Am I now become your enemy because I tell you the truth?" So with the Galatians, the love had changed to enmity, but by God's grace it changed back again to love. But it wasn't so with the Philippians. They loved the Apostle Paul since he had served in their conversion. Think Acts 16 again. Think Lydia at the ladies' prayer meeting by the river. Think the poor wench that was saved from a life of fortune telling. Think the Philippian jailer, that hardened old man. And then think that when they were very young Christians, just when Paul had gone a few miles down the road, there they were giving sacrificially to help him. And then from that time, a constant love for the apostle. And then when they had opportunity, when they knew Paul was in bonds in Rome and could do with their help, they gave him a gift, sent it many hundreds of miles to the west from northern Greece, in our language, to Rome. And so Paul rejoiced greatly. So Paul takes this opportunity to encourage and commend this church for their godly walk. "Notwithstanding," he says in verse 14, "you have well done that ye did share with me in my affliction." Your gift to me is noble, excellent. It's a beautiful thing. Be encouraged. Keep doing what you're doing, he writes to these dear Philippians. There's much here, of course, that's instructive for us too, and you'll have felt it as this passage is opened up and explained. And the first and most obvious thing is that Paul's joy was not because of their gift, but because of the giver. He sought and desired not monetary gain, but their fruit. He sought that they would have fruit reckoned to their account. That's the language of verse 17. I do not desire a gift. I desire, says the apostle, this is what I want for you, fruit that may abound to your account. And this is a legal thing, a ledger, accounting. That God may write this down as a good work in heaven that you have done by grace. That's what I want for you. And this too is what the church council wants and what I want for you. Fruit. Much fruit. Godly fruit. Godly fruit that may abound and remain. This is the goal and purpose of the Christian church with each and every one of its members. I am the vine, ye are the branches. Herein is my Father glorified. And herein we're fulfilling our role in keeping covenant with God. If ye bear much fruit. How did the Apostle John put it? I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. 3 John verse 4. He uses the word joy, the same word Paul uses throughout Philippians and here in verse 10. I have no greater joy, no greater joy. Nothing brings me more joy, said John, than to see you walk in the truth. I've given my life for it. I'm an old man. And this is it. You walking in the truth. That's what brings me joy. And this is the good fruit which rejoices the hearts of your minister and the council and, of course, of godly members in the congregation. When you see the members of the church encouraging one another, supporting one another, visiting those who are sick, enjoying each other's company, loving one another, men shall know you are my disciples if you love one another. To see family devotions being started, continuing, and bringing forth fruit in the congregation. To hear of members talking about their witnessing to workmates and neighbors, and encouraging them to follow Jesus Christ. To witness, as we've witnessed too, marriages deepening and children learning what it is to honour their parents and wives learning what it is to submit to their husbands. When you come in family visitation, visit the families, then there's none of us perfect, and there's nobody expects anybody to become perfect, never mind become perfect quickly, but you see improvement, some improvement. And you can say there's improvement each year. They're growing. They're growing. You see people coming on as the months and the years pass. This is the goal of the office bearers. This is what Christ sets before us and what the whole work is about. I have no greater joy than to see my children walk in the truth. That's what encourages and puts gladness in the heart of the office bearers in the congregation and the other saints. And of course the opposite is also true. I have no greater distress than to see my children not walk in the truth, engage in envy and slander, which are evil fruits, indulge in schismatic activity and bring other people down, withdraw more and more from the church's activity, fellowship and witness, engage in carnality and pride. Those things bring distress. They bring distress in the same way, this is easy for all of us to understand, the same way in which a parent grieves over a departing child. You see it happening. And there's not a big pile you can do about it. But Paul says, unlike the word of admonition to those Galatians, you've done well. You've done well that ye did communicate with my affliction. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that I see your care of me blossoming and you bringing forth good fruit. And then too, there's the lesson of Paul's charitableness towards these Philippians. He takes the gift which has been sent to him from that Roman city to the city of Rome itself as being from all the church. He does not say, I have this gift, and I know fine well there's a few stingy members in the congregation, and I could guess too that Euodias and Syntyche, whom I've had to admonish in chapter 4, verse 2, didn't contribute a big pile and their heart wasn't in it, because they were not of the same mind in the Lord, and since they weren't of the same mind in the Lord, they couldn't be caught up in doing a good work because they were selfish and bickering. He doesn't say that. He takes it as a gift from the whole church. The whole church gave it. And then he ascribes to the whole church, which gave him this gift, good motives. Now, he didn't know their heart. But because they did a good thing, he takes it as coming with a good motive. You did it because you cared for me, because you were concerned for me in prison, or at least under house arrest. Verse 10, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me has flourished again. He doesn't say, well, maybe these Philippians just sent me this gift because they knew it would annoy the Corinthians. See, when they got in first. Or that it would rub the nose of the Thessalonians in it, that they might look bad. He doesn't attribute to them evil motives. He said, you did it out of care for me, and I take it in that sense. So Paul then did not rejoice in the gift. He rejoiced because of the givers. And more precisely, and this is our third point, he rejoiced greatly in the God of all grace who is revealed in the Lord Jesus Christ. That's how verse 10 begins. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. The gift was the occasion for it. The givers, but I rejoiced in the Lord. I rejoiced in the Lord because he put this in your heart. I thank you, but I thank God for you. I rejoiced in the Lord because he showed me his care through you. I'm glad in him. That's keeping the first commandment. And through you, the triune God made a sacrifice. A sacrifice to himself through this gift. That's verse 18. These things which were sent from you, the apostle says, were an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. And here Paul takes the language and imagery of the Old Testament, the sacrificial system, Leviticus 1 through 7, for example. The animal slain, offered on the altar, so that the smoke goes up before God as a picture of the sacrifice of Christ, and God is well pleased. And God said, what you did for me was a sacrifice. That is, first of all, something which cost you. Cost you. David said in one celebrated occasion, I will not offer to anything to the Lord as a sacrifice which cost me nothing. And so he said to Arauna the Jebusite, I won't allow you to give me your bullocks and oxen and the wood for the fire. I have to buy it off you because it must cost me so as to be valuable. And this sacrifice, your giving this gift to me, it pleases God, not just me. It's a sweet smell. It's the odor of a sweet smell which ascends up, and God breathes it in like perfume, and it delights him. It's acceptable. It's well pleasing. And all he did was give him some money. And here Paul's talking about sacrifices and odors going up before the Lord and fruit and blossom. No, but it's more than that. It's not just a coat or money. It's a sign of grace, and God is pleased with it. Let me compare this latter part of verse 18 with its sacrificial language with something else the Apostle Paul wrote from his first Roman captivity some months before. I'm thinking of Ephesians 5 verse 2. Ephesians 5 verse 2, calling to the church to imitate Christ by walking in love, as Christ also hath loved us, and then especially this, and hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savour. Sacrifice. Sacrifice to God. Offering. Savour. Sweet-smelling savour. Same language. Related ideas. And through this sacrifice of Jesus Christ for our sins, Ephesians 5 verse 2, when he died the just for the unjust to bring us back to God, and through the effects of this sacrifice, in not only justifying us, but sanctifying us, and through the continuation of the work of that sacrifice, Christ sitting at God's right hand, not only as a king, but as a priest, interceding for us and purifying our good works. Through all that, all our good works, the good works of the church collectively, seen here concretely in this gift for the suffering apostle, through Christ's sacrifice, there's another sacrifice which goes up, ascending to God as a sweet-smelling savour. Our good works, in which God is well pleased. He finds them very acceptable. I rejoiced, says the apostle, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly at the occasion of this gift. My heart is glad at the good works of the saints and of this church, and therein do I rejoice and will rejoice.